Good morning and welcome to the Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. With me behind the glass is Matt Neely, keeping me on time and on target. Matt, it's great to see you this morning.
Good morning, Ted.
So, Matt, we are a nation bound by shared values of freedoms, liberty, and equality. And with that comes some rights and responsibilities. For some, that includes service to our country, and for others, to our community. And that's the purpose of the engagement hours. What we are trying to do is encourage you to get involved. We do need to take our most sacred right of voting, and we'll talk about that a little bit this morning, serious, and everyone should be engaged. There's no excuse for not voting at a minimum to fulfill your rights and responsibility to the freedoms we've got in this country. But what we like to talk about on this show quite often are to other people who serve, either in the public sector or in the private sector, the nonprofit world, if they're elected officials, first responders. There's a ton of different ways to serve, but the most important thing is to think of what you can do. Not everybody can do everything. Not everybody has the time, the opportunities, the means to do that. Just think of what you can do to make our community a better place, because that is important. I mean, we hear the news every morning, Matt, and we go, God, can we use more people helping out?
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, really, the guy fell in the trench?
Yeah, running from the cops. And he had an extensive criminal history. So He depended on public safety people to, you know, help him.
To help him. As they do. So the Morning Voice, 5 days a week from 7 to 9 o'clock every morning, 5 different hosts each day of the week, 5 different topic areas. For some of us, there's a little bit more politics involved, but you should be able to find something on those 5 shows that you like listening to your drive time. So I encourage you to tune in with us every day. Today, we've got a great show lined up. At the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Todd Rockoff, the president and CEO of the Tucson Jewish Community Center. And last night was their opening ceremony for the Maccabi Games.
Indeed.
And it was quite the event. And we'll have an opportunity to talk to Todd about what brought him to Tucson, but more importantly, what these games are bringing to Tucson as well, and how you can get out and see some of these youth and some of the events they do and some of the athletic competitions if you are so interested. And then the second hour, we're going to be joined by Jan Lesher, the administrator of Pima County. And there are so much to talk about with Jan. There's everything from the RTA and where that's going in the direction. Jan serves as the chair of the Technical Management Committee. There's Project Blue. There's just a ton of issues going on at the county. And, of course, there's the upcoming elections. So, Matt.
Yeah, that.
Big news came out. Jim Nensel broke the news 2 days ago. There was another article this morning by Charles Borla in the Arizona Daily Star, talking about nearly 1,300 citizens of Tucson were sent incorrect ballots.
And I think
for
Channel
the August
4,
primary.
I think Channel 4 beat them both to the punch.
I think they did too. There's a lot of times the TV stations are the ones that pick up the news and tend to break it. And then it's good to see people go out and do a little bit more digging. We've learned more. I mean, 1,300 ballots. And everybody knows that in primaries, voter turnout tends to be low anyway.
Mm-hmm. It is summertime and people are on vacation, you know, but and people aren't thinking about.
But they just figured this out. And as I think we've talked about a lot on this show, is this fall, Tucson will be electing in wards 3, 5, and 6, their city council members. I've pointed it out several times, it's an incredible time in the city of Tucson. And these votes and who gets elected will make a big difference in the way going forward, because for the first time in quite a while, I'd say you've got a diversity of thought in the candidates running in the Democratic election.
Sure.
We've had Leighton Rockefeller on, who's running in Ward 6. The show's a longtime friend of Jesse Lugo, who's running in Ward 5. And there's choices to be made this time. And now we're facing snafus.
And let's just be clear about it. Mayor Romero has candidates that she backs in wards 5 and 6, right? So she's looking to kind of strengthen her grip on the city council and city policy.
And you can't blame her for doing that.
I'm not blaming her. I'm just saying, if there, when you say there is an opportunity for change, I would argue that even if people voted in Democrats, that there is an opportunity to at least provide some sort of deflection point on the current course of the city, even if Democrats sweep, which, you know, I'm not a city resident.
Let's step back. And we've had Jay Tolkoff on this show, and I think he's got a lot to offer, and he's not what you'd call a staunch conservative Republican. He's got a lot to offer all the voters of the city of Tucson. He would be great. But we know because of the system, where the city of Tucson has been, the last Republican elected was Steve Kasachek, who immediately became a Democrat and got reelected multiple times.
Yep.
I mean, and that was a long time ago against Nina Trasoff.
2007, maybe? Yeah. It was a ways
like
back.
2009.
Maybe a long time ago. Yeah, it was a long while ago.
But the challenge is, this was discovered just last week after three voters told the recorder's office.
Right.
So if it wasn't for voters all of a sudden actually looking at their ballots and going, huh.
What's this?
That's not my ward, or that's not my party. Actually, it was the wrong party. They were mailed to the members of the wrong party. So that's not my party. I'm not, you know. Mm-hmm. But what gets interesting is what happened afterwards. So how does that happen? How do you get mailed a ballot for the wrong party? And the recorder's office came out and said that there was an error resulted from a need to override a mechanism in the data system. So there's mechanisms in the data system to protect their integrity.
That's scary, and they're overriding them.
And they had to override it that prevents party changes during an active election.
Right.
Now, they've had some weird ones this year. I'll give them some credit. CD7 special election going on. You've got a recall down in South Tucson going on. And then you've got how can you be in there fiddling with people's party affiliation?
Right.
That's the part that doesn't make sense. Yesterday, when the Daily Star reached out to the recorder's office, they agreed to speak to them Tuesday afternoon, then declined to answer questions about why the system needed to be override. So I think we've got some questions to be answered on that front. But
the thing that scares me is election day for the primary is August 5th. That's Tuesday. There's precious little time, right? To, oh my gosh, I've got the wrong ballot, and then go get the right ballot. Because remember, Ted, this is all by mail.
Right.
Now, which is just messed up.
You can drop off at a replacement site. They call it a replacement. Mm-hmm. You can drop off the by mail ones. There are places you can drop them off. You can't pick up a ballot. You can't fill them out. You can't do that. But their solution said voters who have already submitted their ballot or who vote at the replacement sites can request a provisional ballot from the office. Well, it's going to be interesting to see, and there's going to be a lot of arguments and confusion. But again, it is in the primary. But something you mentioned to me the other day, Matt, I mean, how close this is to the end of the primary is terrible. One of your concerns is how understaffed the recorder's office is.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, they were understaffed in the June vacancies report that Ms. Lesher presents to the board, and it's worse this month. So the recorder's office is 30% of their positions are vacant. 128 positions in the Pima County recorder's office are vacant. It was 29.6% vacancy last month. So it actually got worse during the time that there are two elections in progress. Okay.
Now, and three, don't forget about South Tucson.
You're right.
So
three. You're absolutely right. Three recall election in South Tucson. I stand corrected. That makes it even worse. And then if you go over to the elections department, their headcount is 142. They have 30 positions vacant, 21.1% vacancy rate, which is the same as last month. So that's more than one in five. And the recorder's office is 3 in 10 are vacant. And then they're making mistakes. And Ted, this is not the first time they've made mistakes. They made two similar mistakes to the big ones that are up now in this election last time. So in 2024, they sent out ballots that had the wrong election day on them. Okay. That was in the 2024 election.
Oh, yeah.
Had the wrong date on them. And then they followed that one up by saying, by sending out the ballots late because they missed the deadline because they did not have their maps prepared. They didn't do their work. They didn't do their work on time. So their maps were incorrect. And then they sent them to the printer late. And then they sent them to the printer late, and it set everybody back. And then it caused mass confusion, right, when people didn't get their ballot and they called in for a replacement ballot. And the sad thing about all that is in her own after action report, where the county recorder, Gabriella Cazares-Kelly, referred to the 2024 election as, quote, wildly successful. I thought that was an overly generous take on the thing. She said, "We're confident that most voters who requested a ballot using our online form either received their already queued ballots, voted early in person, updated their address online, or successfully requested a mail ballot." Most
is not a good word when you talk about.
Everybody wants to vote should vote.
Everybody's, when it's the fundamental right and responsibility of the citizens of our nation, is to vote.
This is the big one.
It shouldn't be a most.
This is the big one.
And for the record, it was 267,000 ballots that were delayed in sending out last
Thank
time.
Thank you for remembering that number. 000. I remember, yeah.
It's a big number. So then they
send out the thing and they say, well, you know, we're going to check everything. We're going to triple check everything next time. And don't worry, we've got safeguards and we've learned from our problems with the 2024 election. Now, the 2025 elections come up. I just happened to notice this the other day. On the webpage, they had important 2025 election dates, and then you clicked on it and you got a PDF. Well, all of a sudden I noticed a lot of the dates were different, a couple of days off between them. So,
On
the webpage, on the primary election, the city of Tucson, it said the last day to request mail ballots was July 25th. And then on the PDF version, it said July 23rd. And I mean, it goes on and on. In the November 20, where was the one about recommended deadline to mail back your ballot for the general election, the city of Tucson general election? One calendar said October 28th was the deadline to mail back your ballot. The other said October 29th. There was a day off. Well, that day might mean a bunch of people don't get their ballots in. And there were five or six dates that were different between. So they had updated one document and not updated it in another place. They're understaffed. I get back to you. They get wildly understaffed. And then, so that's the calendar issue. And then you have the issue of incorrect ballots were sent to people to vote in a mail-only election.
And I don't know, this may not be popular to some people's thought, but to me, running an election is one of the most critical things you can do.
It's the big one, Ted.
So it's
That's
the
big one.
And why that is something that in theory could turn over every 4 years because it's an elected position. It's an elected position. I want an expert in there that can do it. I want somebody who can manage and control. It's kind of like the state mine inspector. Really, we're still electing a state mine inspector?
Yeah.
I would think that would be something that somebody would be an expert at. There's so many things we do historically because we do. I mean, the county sheriff. We elect a county sheriff.
Right.
Why?
Close election, too.
Yeah.
And when you get close elections like this, and then you find out, well, some people, you know, we rushed this vote center system. We rushed this vote center system into place. And, oh, we've made it easier for everybody to vote. Well, maybe not.
Matt, you know, that's all right. I guess you didn't work liking what I was about to say. So you know what would make it easier in the city of Tucson for their election system? Why don't you try doing what the other 28 of 29 charter cities have nonpartisan open primary or nonpartisan elections.
Uh-huh.
Open primary. The ones that have district, they do it by districts only. So it's ward only type.
Yeah.
Why doesn't the city of Tucson, instead of having this confusing one-off kind, oh, by the way, we're the only one, again, nonpartisan, the only one that even puts the party affiliations on the ballot.
Wow.
Why don't we do what the other 28 cities, very successful, many of them, in a lot of cases do.
Uh-huh.
Why don't we just conform with the rest of the charter cities in the state of Arizona and run an election like them?
Interesting.
You know, and Jim Senex put an article out today talking about, he did an op-ed in the Daily Star on why he thought ranked choice voting would be better. He's running on a campaign platform of that ward only needs to be incurred. Right. You know, and this is a Democrat out there saying that. This isn't a Republican. This is a Democrat saying our system is not a representative form of government. because people outside, the people being represented, get to select.
Yeah.
So it just, it's of all the things.
Yeah, the hybrid, and I guess we got to go to break, but,
well,
but
yeah,
the
we
hybrid,
do.
The hybrid where the ward picks the candidates for each party and then citywide voting, that, for starters, that's got to go. Nonpartisan, I don't know. I guess I could get on board.
Nobody
with
else
first
does
things
it.
First, man, you got to get rid of this stupid hybrid voting
you
system.
You do, and nobody else does it.
Which has roots in bad things in the past.
If you don't think they don't know in Tempe, in Mesa, in Phoenix, what the person's party affiliation is, you're going to know.
I can get my head wrapped around the nonpartisan city elections.
But I absolutely can. Let's make it easy. All right. Matt, great talk. I didn't think we'd go this long. We're going to cover Project Blue. We want to hear Matt Neely's opinion on Project Blue when we get back. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk.
Follow along on Facebook or YouTube. 1030 The Voice is the name of the channel on YouTube. 1030 The Voice is our page on Facebook. Like, follow, subscribe, whatever, and see your voice.
Back. You are listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass. Thanks for that first segment, Matt. That was enjoyable. So I think we just keep it rolling for 10 more minutes and let's go and talk a little bit about Project Blue. But first, I have to send out some special birthday wishes.
Yes, you do.
Today, several years ago on this date, Katie, my wife, was born. So happy birthday. And I could not do this life without you. So I really appreciate it all. And I hope you have an incredible birthday today. And I better do a little bit to make sure that that happens. So
happy birthday, Katie. That's awesome.
All right. Now, based on that, how do you like that? Happy birthday wishes lead into Project Blue.
Uh-huh.
Really important for people to listen. This is one of those opportunities I tell everybody. I tell our members. I tell other folks that are in the business community. They're going, we need to start doing a campaign. I know right now on any kind of issues, as citizens, call your wards. The wards are getting pounded in the opposition. If you're a supporter of Project Blue, they need to hear from you too. They want to know our voices. The two upcoming meetings, if you really don't understand Project Blue or you want to, the one that is going to be held this Thursday, originally it was going to be in person, but it's now going to be a virtual Microsoft Teams meeting.
Right.
Get that information. That is probably the meeting that I think you're going to have the best opportunity to learn about the project, to hear answers. They're going to probably take questions via the chat. You're actually going to have a whole 2-hour period where they're going to get to tell you about it,
mm-hmm.
pros and cons, and answer the hard questions.
Obviously, the last one's a little bit boisterous.
Oh, you think?
So,
you think?
I'm master of understatement, I know.
And if you think that one was bad, I haven't figured out if I'm going to go attend yet. I may watch it just from the virtual world to see how it is. But the one on August 4th from 5 to 7 will be in person, and they've decided to hold it at the Grand Ballroom at the TCC.
Mm-hmm.
They are expecting a massive turnout. Here's the problem I have with part. We may get to some other start on Project Blue. Here's the problem I've got with the voices and with these open public meetings, these listening sessions.
Mm-hmm.
It was just chaos last time.
Right.
And there were people.
That's counterproductive.
I can't tell you how many times the speakers had to stand down and wait. City Manager Tamir, I thought, did a pretty formidable role of managing it and keeping it on track. But, you know, at the very beginning, but he said, listen, if this keeps up, this meeting's going to be shorter than it was advertised.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no teeth in that.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to shut it down. They weren't going to remove people, but they need to. I think some people misrepresent what the First Amendment gives you the right to do.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Everybody in there has the right to say what they want to say. But it doesn't give you the right to prevent other people from saying what they want to say either. And you've got to control an environment like that. I was real disappointed that they didn't remove some people. You know, I heard somebody from the work that works for the city said, well, yeah, it was just as bad because the people when the union started talking, they started clapping and applauding too. Well, of course, if one side gets loud, the other side's going to get
mm-hmm.
loud.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
This is supposed to be an informational program. That's why I think the one on Thursday will be very, very solid. The one on at the TCC may be very entertaining. But today, if in the Arizona Daily Star, and yes, I'm telling you a lot of good articles in this Daily Star today, op-eds. There were two op-eds that were really well-written, I think, stated a lot of the pros, a lot of the reasons to support it. One was by Joe Snell.
Okay.
And he's the president CEO of the Chamber of Southern Arizona. He literally put his in his op-ed today, gave reasons for why you would want to support it, depending who you were. you know, not just from the business side of the project, but that he says the data center aligns with the city of Tucson's approach. It fits with their Tucson One Water 2010 plan. It fits with the TEP's 2050 net zero plan. And it shows from that side of the house, it's going to fund a lot of the stuff the city wants to do that they don't have the money to fund. I mean, think about the 18 miles of purple pipe. And sure, for people are listening, purple pipe is, and it's actually purple. I asked that question. That's what designates.
It's the reclaimed water that they're going to take to them.
Exactly.
Right? They're
it designates that this pipe has reclaimed water in it. Treated reclaimed water. It's not,
yes,
it's not toilet to data,
yeah,
center.
Right.
You know, it's treated reclaimed water. And the city of Tucson's made it very clear, and I agree with this totally, reclaimed water is going to be a big part of our water future in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, we don't use much of it. Yes, we put a lot of it back into the ground. It takes years for that to get back into the system.
Mm-hmm.
We lose a lot of it because of evaporation. There's a lot of other things that play into it. But eventually, Project Blue will be totally using reclaimed water and putting effectively 100% back in. You know, I don't like the water positive comments they've made about they're giving more water back, because a lot of that is paper water. And paper water is different, you know.
Okay.
I agree with that. But he goes on to, do you work in one of the major industries? Well, here's why you should support it. Do you work or attend the University of Arizona? Project Blue is going to almost give a ability for some of the stuff they want to do at TEP is going to be incredible. Now, man, I guess we talked too much on that first segment.
That's probably my fault.
So, when we do come back sometime today, I'm going to fit in your opinion on Project Blue.
Okay.
But there's another op-ed in there, Jesse Lugo. Read it.
Okay.
It's why Jesse Lugo's the best candidate in Ward 5.
Yep.
He said right now he would be a no for all the reasons. And he's thinking about his community and the members of Ward 5 when he writes that. But I think it would be a great opportunity to read that. So appreciate everybody being with us this morning. We'll come back from the bottom of the hour break with Todd Rockoff, the president of the Tucson Jewish Community Center. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. See you after the bottom of the hour ads. Good morning and welcome back. You are listening to The Morning Voice. Appreciate you being with us for the first half hour. If you just joined us, glad you tuned in. We did a little political ranting in the first part, talking about the elections in the city, upcoming elections in the city of Tucson, and some of the problems the county's having in administering those correctly, as well as hitting on a little Project Blue. We'll have an opportunity in the third hour when Jan Lesher joins us to talk a lot more on that issue as well. But right now, I am honored to be joined by Todd Rockoff, the president CEO of the Tucson Jewish Community Center. Todd, welcome to the show. I appreciate you taking the time. This is a very busy week for you, so I'm glad to have you join us.
Thanks, Ted. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and you're right, it's a super busy week, but it's also a really exciting week.
Well, it is, and I want to jump to that. We're talking about the Maccabi Games. For any of you that don't know what the Maccabi Games are, I hope we'll fill you in. There's a great article in the Daily Star this morning, again, that will give a little bit more details if you want it. But Todd, before we jump into that, I just want to talk a little bit about your background. And, you know, the show is about encouraging people to get engaged, involved, and the Tucson Jewish Community Center is such an engaging and involved organization throughout our community. What brought you here, and how did you get involved in the JCC?
You know, so I've been now in the JCC movement for the last 40 years. I've had the honor of working in four different communities, this being my fourth. And when this opportunity came up and I really had the opportunity to think about throwing my hat in the ring, I was excited because I knew the reputation that the Tucson JCC have had in our field and the remarkable job that Ken Light and the lay leadership had done here before. So I was excited to participate in the process and really honored to be given the role. I am starting my 13th year here this July, and it's really been great because I learned not just is Tucson hot, but the warmth of this community is really the special sauce.
Well, that's a good way to put it, and it's a good spin on, yes, it's hot, and we're okay, we'll get through it. So it's hot right now, and you've got Jewish teen athletes from the United States, Canada, Israel, Ukraine, and Moldova. all converging here to participate in kind of an Olympic style events, but it's the Maccabi Games are much more than that. So can you kind of discuss how the Maccabi Games came about and what the purpose, I guess, not just the athletic endeavors, but the purpose of those events, the games are?
Sure. The JC Maccabi Games started in 1982 with one set of games in Memphis, Tennessee. And it really was, as you described, it's kind of the Jewish teen Olympics. And the real intent and purpose was to bring Jewish teens together for an immersive activity centered around athletics and around what we call Jewish peoplehood and developing a connection to one another. And over the last 43 years, that has grown from one community doing it a year to two and even sometimes three communities doing it a year. And we are serving, in this particular summer, we have almost 1,000 athletes here in Tucson, including 75 of our own. And we are joined by about 850 athletes from around the world, as you said. And the week after ours, there's a set of games in Pittsburgh. One of the beautiful parts of the games is that the athletes are housed in local families' homes. So we have a blend here. We're doing what we call a hybrid model. We have a large number of athletes that are in community homes. And as always, our community opens up their doors and is generous and wonderful. And then we've created an Olympic Village experience. So the kids have this opportunity to compete, get to know each other, understand where there are differences geographically, but that the emotional connection to one another is closer than the geographic distance of where they live. And we're honored to have about 50 kids from Israel, almost a dozen kids from the Ukraine, and three athletes from Moldova joining us with athletes from the United States and Canada. And they compete in the kind of sports that you would expect. And in between, they have an opportunity to socialize, trade pins, get to know each other. Today, last night was opening ceremonies, and today is really not just a day of athletic competition, but we are doing something called JCC Cares, which are community service projects where all the teens participate today and tomorrow, working alongside other local nonprofits. So we're honored to partner with both Ben's Bells and Youth on Their Own. And these kids will not only have the experience to assemble and paint and do those things, but also learn about the mission of these two really wonderful organizations here in our community. And for us, it's a tacit example of the J as a real community partner and community organization.
I think that's something that's missed in this community a lot. I played basketball for years at the Jewish Community Center. It was a great facility. It was a great opportunity. Got to know a lot of people. I personally am not Jewish, but the JCC is open for all. And you do an incredible job of outreach to the community. What would be your message to this community about your organization?
The JCC, we believe that everyone belongs and some people join. So what we mean by that when we say it is obviously we love our members and those who choose to join, but we also are saying everyone belongs and we belong with everyone. So we are here to be in service to and a part of the broader Jewish community outside of ourselves and the broader community as a whole. And we try to work together with others. We're really honored to have opportunities from time to time to work closely with the YMCA and other community organizations. And as I mentioned, here at the Games, we're working with three community organizations. I've already mentioned Ben's Bells. And I'll highlight that as every teen came from out of town, they came with an item to donate to Diamond Children's Hospital Play Zone. The Play Zone is a wonderful service in our community for families and children that are in need of the services at Diamond Children's Hospital. And they provided us a list of things that they need. And we distributed that out to all the athletes, and on their way in, each of them, if you will, was kind of like their entry. They put something in the basket, and we've been able to help populate the supplies that the play zone needs, hopefully for a reasonable amount of time as each of these kids brought something together. So the message of the J is that we are here for everyone, and we are really proud of the role that we play in the broader community. And we are really proud in doing so that we remain an authentically Jewish organization, and proud of our mission and vision, and really honored that resonates with so many members of our broader community.
Well, as I said, I'm a big fan of the work you do in the community, and you are about bringing people together. And I love the statement, you know, everyone belongs and some people join. That is really a statement. But these games, while I think when we come back after a break, we're not going to go there yet, but when we come back after the break, we'll talk more about the actual games and some of the other events, some of the speakers the kids are going to be exposed to while they're here, and some of the youth gathering and you know, the getting together. But I want this also, when one of the first times you and I talked about the Maccabi games was when you were out starting to try to do some fundraising support for it. And I did not realize the economic impact and the number of visitors, total visitors we'd bring. Can you talk a little bit about what the games mean to this region?
Yeah, so the JCC Maccabi games being here, they started really Sunday with arrivals, and they'll end next Friday. And the economic impact is about $5 million to our community in this 1 week. And that's because while we house families in local host families' homes, the parents that come to watch their kids compete, they don't have to take care of their kids. We do that. So they leave the competition and they eat in our local restaurants, and they stay in our local hotels, and they shop in our stores because there's a lot of downtime. You know, basketball games only so long, and even if they play two in a day, these families have a lot of time to enjoy Tucson. And you know, one of the things that really made me very happy was listening to a couple of families say, you know, we may come back here in the winter and vacation. We had never been to Tucson. We had never been to the Old Pueblo. And what we've discovered is it's absolutely beautiful. You know, they're staying in summertime rates, and we worked with Visit Tucson to get even better rates than that for some of them. And they're staying in these beautiful resorts. So we'd love to welcome them back to Tucson for, you know, that's the tail of the economic impact that's not even included. And then, of course, all of the coaches and delegation heads, both Sunday night when they don't have responsibilities for programming and tomorrow night, are all talking about, you know, where's the best Mexican restaurant?
you need to take a poll of that, right? Yeah, you need to take a poll at it too and find out what really sold well and what people really like. That'd be great to know.
So, you know, they want to find that. And, you know, what we've been encouraging them is no chain. You know, go find the amazing food in this city of gastronomy.
Absolutely. It's a great opportunity. And this time of the year, bringing that kind of economic impact to this region at this time of the year, and to have people say, wow, I want to come back in the winter when maybe it's even greener and it's plusher and the temperatures aren't quite as hot. So, I mean, you'd have an athletic event here in the summer. Those athletes, they are putting some big effort into it. So that was the voice of Todd Rockoff, the president and CEO of the Tucson Jewish Community Center. And we'll be right back after the break to talk more about the JCC Maccabi Games.
Don't forget, you can follow along on Facebook or YouTube. 1030 The Voice is the channel on YouTube. 1030 The Voice is the page on Facebook. You can see your voice, even in the summertime.
And welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. We're joined by Todd Rockoff, the president and CEO of the Tucson Jewish Community Center. And Todd, during the break, I got a text from a listener saying, I don't think you're pronouncing those games right. So what is the official pronunciation?
So, yeah, there's a variety of pronunciations that people will look at. But these specific games are the JCC Maccabi games. There is an international set of games that are the Maccabiah, and people are often most familiar with the Maccabees, which is the story of Hanukkah. But the games are the Maccabi games, and you're getting it right. And I appreciate the listener, because there are a variety of different ways that you can pronounce it. So, you know, they are likely using one of the other two that I mentioned.
Well, we've been talking so far about the not only the economic impact and the ability that you've brought by bringing all these folks in to show off our region to do it. There's a part of the games that I want to talk about too, and that's the Access Program. Can you give us some details on what that is?
Sure. The JCC Maccabi Access is the aspect of the games that are for teens with developmental and intellectual disabilities. And, you know, we really wanted the games to be for everyone and to be as inclusive as possible. And myself and a couple of my colleagues, Betsy Lynch from San Diego, Scott Ehrlich from Fort Lauderdale, sat down with JCC Association of North America probably about 5 years ago. And we started noodling around and thinking of what could we do. And we birthed the idea of JCC Maccabi Access. And we piloted the program for 3 years, the games in San Diego, the games in Fort Lauderdale, and then in Houston. And at the end of the pilot, the task was to determine, is this a fixture and a regular part of the games? And we determined that it was, and we're really honored to host the first JCC Maccabi Access games outside of the pilot phase. And we are really thrilled. It started with seven teens. And this year we have 25 teens here with us that are participating in both distinct activities and competitions amongst each other, as well as some integrated games and activities with other participants in the games themselves. And their experience is a little bit shorter. It's Sunday to Wednesday, but the impact is absolutely remarkable. They actually, the other day I was watching them, it was actually yesterday, just the days were very long, watching them do some Krav Maga, which is an Israeli style self-defense program. And to kick it off, each of them, they had this large ball they were passing around, and they had to all say their name, where they're from, and do a fun dance move. And to watch these kids lose their inhibition, to feel comfortable with one another, and to get to know each other is really gratifying. To see kids who have come a couple of years through the pilot program returning this year, and they know each other, they're friends. Some of them have stayed in touch during the in-between, you know, the rest of the year outside of the games. So it really is it's a tacit demonstration that the JCC Maccabi games really are for all Jewish youth, not just those that might be able to compete at a higher level. It's a very, very inspiring program, and I give hats off to all that help create these experiences of meaning, and look forward to this being a part of it for many, many years to come.
Well, I think that's a great point, and a big point of what the purpose of this game is. It's to bring together community as a whole, inclusion, bringing everybody together, getting folks to be exposed to friends, people, and communities like the city of Tucson that they may not be exposed to otherwise. And so that is such a strength of these games. So we've got about 2 more minutes left, Todd. So how can people participate or watch, or more importantly, support these games as they continue to flourish the rest of the week here in Tucson?
We, you know, there is a way for people to come and spectate. They can go onto our website and look for the JCC Maccabi games and register to be a spectator. You're welcome to. It is a bit of a process, but you're able to get a spectator pass. And you can come and watch any of the games. You'll be able to find out where they're taking place. And the J looks forward to doing other large-scale community events, and we are certainly always looking for volunteers. Same process, if somebody wanted to, is so inclined, today, tomorrow, Thursday, hop on the website, register to be a volunteer, and there is likely a few shifts that we have left to cover. But, you know, you and I both know Tucson, and people have been really great in raising their hands and, you know, honestly taking some time off of work to spend their time doing something greater than themselves. And that's really one of the highest purposes of what we try to do. And we have been fortunate that we have been the recipient of great generosity here in Tucson. And, you know, this is a big endeavor. So we, you know, we can always use a little more financial support, and there's opportunities again on the website to donate.
Absolutely. And that website's jccmaccabitucson.com. So that's jccmaccabitucson.com. You can get information. Thanks for joining us today, Todd. This is a great event. Thank you for bringing it to Tucson, and I wish you the best of luck this week.
Ted, thanks so much for everything that you do and that you continue to do for our community.
Look forward to seeing you soon, Todd. You're listening to 1030 Bye-bye. The Voice, trusted local news and talk, and we'll be right back with Jan Lesher, the county administrator for Pima County. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I am Ted Maxwell, your host. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping us on time and target. I always just enjoy saying that, Matt. You know, on time, on target's just always one of those fun things to good. You always grin a little bit, so it's great. It's great to put that one out there.
I've got 20 hours and a 152, Ted. So you know,
hey, you've got 20 hours and a 152, and no accidents. So well done. I tell you, it is a little concerning to me.
I was 16 at the time.
That's even better. That means it's time to go back up. I get more concerned. You know, we flew up to Sedona this weekend and flew back on Sunday, and when we came back to the pattern at Marana, it was packed. I mean, small aviation is so popular in Arizona. It's the perfect weather conditions. It's perfect flying. We had at least one solo student, if not two, in the pattern. And the challenge with these smaller airports, Ryan at least has a tower. Marana's getting a tower. Right. You want to go to an uncontrolled airfield when you're a small aircraft. Why? Because it's easy. If there's nobody in the pattern, you can just do a pattern. But when it gets busy, then it gets hectic. And we've seen the tragedies that can happen out as they have out at Marana. But I don't think people understand the amount of small aviation that's in Arizona. So enough said about that. That's the Matt Neely, Ted Maxwell aviation talk. But we are joined today by Jan Lesher.
Good morning,
Jan. It's great to have you here. County Administrator for Pima County. Up front, I'm going to say it loud and clear. I'm going to probably give her a hard time on some issues today, but I greatly respect you. You stepped into what I would call a very, very difficult role, because Chuck Huckleberry was a legend and a strong point inside of Pima County for years.
Absolutely.
I know you worked with him in that role as well. But people either love or hated Chuck. And that's not I don't mean literally hated. They just either loved his policies and how he ran things, or they weren't particularly fond of him. You've kind of brought what I'd call a stabilizing force into that role. You're basically working with all sides of everything, and you listen, take input, and you do it. And I think you've been doing an outstanding job in that role.
We're all trying. It's a wonderful team, as you know.
Yeah. So one of the things that we talk about on this show is that people need to get engaged and get involved and serve your community. And you've served your community in that political space, but not as a politician for many years. So can you just give people a short recap of some of the roles, you know, in state government, in federal government, that you've had before you came back to Pima County?
Well, and I think, Ted, I go back, I was reminding someone the other day, I went door to door on a campaign the first time when I was 8 years old on my bicycle. So we have been engaged in this community.
So in 2012?
I'm going to go with that. Okay. That's about right. But I was raised to get involved and to participate. This is my hometown. So that's, you know, what we've always done. And then did a lot of different things. Finally, in 1990, started Lesher Communications, had a small business, ran a small business up until the end of 2002, when I went to work for Janet Napolitano, then governor, served there, first ran the Southern Arizona office, then was moved on up to Phoenix, was the director of the Department of Commerce, and then moved over and was the chief of staff for the governor, was in that role when she became the Secretary of Homeland Security. So I went with her to the Department of Homeland Security and was chief of staff at DHS with a pledge to stay a year. I stayed about 16 months and came back. It was a couple of times. It's one of those experiences I am so very glad I had. And I'm really glad I'm not doing it now. But it'd
be a different world now, boy, no doubt.
Boy, and just part of it. I mean, that was I was there for the what they called Snowmageddon. Government closed down four times for snow. You couldn't get to work unless
you have that problem here.
No, and I live next door to the secretary, so we always found a way to get her to work, and I just went along for the ride. So great times. But it's certainly helped me when you've got 240,000 employees around the world in a $52 billion budget. It helps understand. And I balance that with having run a small business with four and five employees, where it's truly a matter of you eat what you kill, you know. And so I think I hopefully bring both ends of the spectrum or balance to the table now.
Well, I think you do on that front. What was your biggest, I mean, obviously state government's one thing, but I can't imagine working in the bureaucracy and the swirly of Washington, yeah, D.C. with all the different voices, all the different elected officials that are playing in both sides of the aisle. It's just constant. Yeah. I mean, my goal was to stay away from the Pentagon and the military because I felt it was going to be the same thing. Yeah. What was your biggest takeaway from those 16 months in D.C.?
I will tell you what's astonishing to going to DHS, again, 240,000 people, there's about 400 political appointees, which means the vast majority are individuals there to serve the government. And when you look at a Homeland Security, and that's the Coast Guard and TSA and the Secret Service, ICE, CBP, just extraordinary group of men and women all around the world dedicated to keeping the nation safe and keeping our homeland safe. And part of that, I go back, you know, at the time, we also have the, we were dealing with H1N1.
Yep.
And hard to remember at that time, there was no appointed Secretary of Health and Human Services. Kathleen Sebelius became the secretary, but was not at the time. So everything pivoted to DHS, and we didn't know if it was a terrorist attack on the homeland or not. We didn't know whether you shut down the airports to bring international travelers into the country or not. We didn't know whether you have people at TSA wearing masks and guards, or is that the welcoming message? So everything is just so exploded. You know, here, one or two people may be involved. You're dealing with people around the world. And I used to tell the boss, each of whom seemed to have reply all. It's what it felt like most days. But I think it's understanding the importance of a FEMA, going through hurricanes, getting ready for what's happening in parts of this country when you're seeing the devastation of hurricanes and tornadoes, and making sure that FEMA is ready. We saw floods early on in the administration. We watched a flood up at Red River, which was, splitting North Dakota and Michigan, very, very different states, some large, some small. It was just amazing to really learn and understand the impact of those services.
Well, there's no doubt. I'm a big believer in state government and local government. I think the closer you get to your household in your home, the greater impact the government has on you. There's no doubt about
that. Absolutely.
But when you get to things of that magnitude, when you get to natural disasters, when you get to events, you know, what we classify as an event, mm-hmm, where something big is beyond, and the tentacles leading into those events could come from anywhere, you have to have a strong system inside
that's
the
right.
federal government. So I think that's a great experience you've had, mm-hmm, in your ability to come back. What would you say the biggest change you've personally seen in the county, or you've had, or you maybe weren't aware of when you're working for the previous, mm-hmm, administrator, and now you are the administrator?
Well, And Ted, I think we might have even talked about it then. I always said I had the best job on the planet. You know, it was good money. I had a good sense of responsibility. I could get things accomplished and completely hide.
You weren't the public
eye
back
unknown,
then.
And be unknown. Yeah. It was a great job. I said the only job I never, ever wanted or wished on anybody was whoever was going to be county administrator after Chuck Huckleberry. And here we are. So what I think it's that you've been there, you understand, and I think for your listeners, looking at the big chair and knowing what you think you're going to do when you're there and how you're going to act and what's going to happen is different than when you're sitting there. And the things you really do have to balance, or the number of times when people would question a decision Chuck made or wonder why I've done something, and people aren't necessarily privy to all the information that you may have in trying to make a decision, or understanding that we work now with, there's 34 departments, 20 elected officials when you consider the constables and the JPs in the mix, and I think it's 54 Superior Court judges, each of whom has a very distinct role. And part of the challenge I think we have, when you look at, you know, we're governed by a 5-member board of supervisors, but then there's another 7 elected officials. So if you look at a city, for example, the mayor and council hire and fire the attorney. They hire and fire the police chief. And in something like the county, these are all shared responsibilities. And actually, sometimes people point out that a member of the board is elected by 1/5 of the county. The sheriff, the assessor, the treasurer, they're elected by the entire county. So there's how we manage the respect and the role of deferring to elected officials and yet helping them manage their budgets or stay within certain guardrails.
You couldn't have set us up better to go into the break. So I'm going to go a little early to break, because when I get back, I want to talk about that specific challenge. And you can either, I'll prep you in advance, but you can either say no comment or give us our opinion on, are all those positions necessary to be elected? Are we putting areas that need expertise in the voters' hands to vote for people who are looking for political positions potentially?
Oh, look at the time.
I figure you might want to cut out. So that's Jan Lesher with us, the Pima County Administrator. We're going to talk about all things county. We're going to start getting into the issues when we get back. So please stay with us. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. We can never get enough Tom Petty in this studio, so appreciate the selections that Matt is making today. We're going to go right back to what you kind of closed us with. And my guest this morning is Jan Lesher, the Pima County Administrator. The challenges of working, you said 27 elected officials?
20.
Mm-hmm. 20 elected officials. Mm-hmm. 5 of them are elected by 1/5 of the county.
Or 5 supervisors.
And all the rest are elected
most? Or? 7 then are elected countywide.
Right.
And then the others, we've got the, you've got 9 justices of the peace.
Which are just from those representing those.
From their smaller areas. But the 7, the sheriff, the assessor, the treasurer, the recorder, the attorney.
Well,
clerk of the court.
Earlier in the SHIP program, I mentioned that there were some positions that I don't understand why we elect them. I mean, you pointed out if the city government, and again, county government's different than city government, not saying it's not, but, you know, then the police chief or any municipality gets hired and fired by the board. County attorneys elected by the citizens. The sheriff's elected by the citizens. The recorder's office. Are there any, what's been the challenge of having that many elected officials inside one entity? And what ones, if you want to go on the record, saying that you could see maybe we shouldn't be electing?
Well, the challenge is how we work together in that some of the elected officials, when they have a budget and I'm talking to them about their budget, or we just went through a big classification compensation study. They come to me and want a certain position at a certain pay raise rate that's not consistent with other parts of the county. Well, they're elected officials, so we absolutely defer to elected officials. They don't work for me. They work for the public. But there's guardrails within our county system with which they need to operate. And so my hope has been I try to meet with them all regularly and just help them understand they can do what they want to do as elected officials within those guardrails. You know, they can't just be a completely different pay structure, things like that. I think that what the county board has looked at in the past several years are things like the constables. These are people who are out working within various geographic areas, serving papers, going to doors, doing eviction notices.
Doing very specific tasks.
Tasks, yes.
They're not really decision. I mean, I'm sure there's some decision making in their process, but they're supposed to do very specific tasks.
Yes.
So why do we elect them?
And well, because we always have under the Arizona Constitution, and in part of it is because the county of Pima has to do what all the other counties do, and those positions are very different in part of rural Arizona. And how they're elected, how they're trusted, how they serve in Graham and Greenlee County is different here, but yet we're all counties in Arizona. And I think what we've seen is a different style. Some constables see it more as a as more of a law enforcement perspective. Others see it more as a social service or social worker perspective. That is unique to that individual. But it then we've seen it where if we are not sure of what the training is, do we have the right people in the right job? And with all the backup and everything that they need appropriately, putting themselves in harm's way. And that's scary.
And it's had dramatic outcomes at times.
It has.
And so, you know, there's nothing beyond the state's ability to say in counties over 2 million,
right,
you do this.
Mm-hmm.
In counties over, because you're right, the rural communities, we don't want to shortfall what their needs
right.
are. But it doesn't prohibit the state constitution or the state language and the statutes from being adjusted to give counties of significant size different opportunities
and,
how to do this.
And they can. And what we see in terms of just how counties do things differently, we, excuse me, in Pima County have a recorder and an elections director. We bifurcate those responsibilities. The recorder does all the voter registration and does all the early voting. And records documents and does a host of things, and that individual is elected. The elections director oversees the elections, you know, and the vote centers and the days and the counting and everything that goes into the tabulation of results. It also, it's the elections department that works with candidates, does the financial reporting, the petitions, all of that. And that individual is hired and fired by me. And I think what it does in Pima County is bifurcate that responsibility. There's a bit of a check and balance rather than having one person reporting to someone who maybe has all the registration and the early ballots and then the counting. There's some when the early ballots leave the recorder, they're counted, they're checked, they're verified. When they arrive at elections, they're counted, they're checked, they're verified. So we always have checks and balances. And then when you're at elections, you always have everybody from every party watching things as
so,
well.
So obviously there's challenges. None of this is easy, especially when you get three specific elections occurring simultaneously. It's very difficult. But, you know, nearly 1,300 incorrect ballots being sent out for an August primary for it not being recognized till, I believe, three voters called the office last week and said, hey, how does, I guess the big question we had when we were talking about it earlier was, there was a need to override the party registrations to make this work, or how does that happen? Where does that fall? Because I like the idea that we've got an expert in doing the election, and then, yeah, maybe you have an elected. I'm concerned, though, that if it's occurring in that phase of it, that having elected officials always isn't the best solution for something that is got to be exact.
Well, and I think you're right. Like you, I received a call late Friday afternoon, early Friday evening, saying we've discovered there's an error, and I'm just looking at 1,294 incorrect ballots. It looks like 358 voters actually received the wrong ballot. We have three elections going on, and so looking at the what happens in terms of there was a need for the recorder's office to override a mechanism in the data system,
right.
I understand, that prevents party changes during an active election. Well, when you've got three active elections, the time frame for when you can turn things on and off for one election is slightly different than the other. And so that's what led to an error being made by the recorder's office in sending the wrong data. The good news, if you will, is that having that information called in and having voters bring that to the recorder's attention, they've scrubbed it, they've seen it, and they believe that at this point, no one voted the incorrect ballot.
Well, that's important. The question is somebody not going to be able to vote? Matt, right. Do you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, so this is the second year. There have been procedural errors. My question is, both elections and recorder's office seem to be perennially understaffed by quite a bit. What role do you think understaffing played in any of this?
We have, Matt, we've recently been adding a lot of staff to both the recorder and the elections office. We have seen those numbers go up. I doubt there's a department in the county that says they have every employee they need, but we have increased the pay for all of the individuals not only full-time within both elections and the recorder, but increased the pay for those temporary workers who come in and help us out just during the elections. So I have not heard that this was a concern related to being understaffed. The concerns we've seen on the election side in the past was when we didn't have enough people to provide 1R and 1D in each vote center in cells or things like that. And we've tried to address that by reaching out earlier, recruiting earlier, increasing the amount we pay. So, Matt, I'm happy to go and get some more information on that and get back with you all. I've not heard that come up in relation to this specific issue this time.
Yeah, I know it was one, Matt, or one of the things we talked about was the challenges of keeping Pima County, how many total employees do you have?
We're about 7,300.
7,300. Mm-hmm. And your shortfalls, if just rough.
About 12.5% vacancy rate.
You know, and to me, those are good jobs to have. They tend to pay. Yeah. So I guess, why is there a challenge? I mean, we in a county that has a county and a city, the city, high levels of poverty, why can't we keep those more full? Is there anything that the community or how can we help out fill those positions?
I think we're doing a much better job doing that. I will tell you, I started looking, obviously, at the end of 21, tracking our vacancy rate. And starting in January of 22, we were running between 21% vacancy rate. And we said, what do we need to do to address this? And we began to look at work culture, work-life balance, salaries, classification, compensation, everything involved in how we hire, how we maintain people, how do we recruit them. So we have ticked that down to about 12.5%.
And that's good. That's an improvement.
It's a big improvement. We've got a ways to go. I mean, we'd certainly like to be better than that. The number one reason that people give for leaving the county is pay. And I think when I go back and look, the departments where we have vacancies and struggles are in the trades. When you look at our facilities guys, the trades, while we might do a comparative when we look at market and what we need to pay with other jurisdictions, they can go to some of the other companies here in town. They can go to a Caterpillar or a different company and earn more. We lose people in the IT field. It's very competitive.
IT field's tough all around.
So that's what I've been watching. What we've done now, we started it. What is it we pay people? What's the compensation? And now we're going back, and I use the vacancy rate to really understand what I'm calling the hard-to-fill positions. And do we need to adjust those salaries, particularly in the IT and the trades?
Well, there's no doubt it's a challenge. I mean, you look at the police force structures inside all the different communities. You're all competing.
Yep.
You're all competing for those who want to work in the public sector. And then you're also competing with the private sector, which is extremely difficult.
So that's
Jan Lesher, the Pima County Administrator. When we come back, let's get into some of the topics. Maybe a little Project Blue, maybe some RTA.
Okay.
You know, some not
non-controversial stuff.
There you go, the easy stuff. Okay.
We'll leave the elections out of this.
Softened us up, and now we do that. Got it.
All right. You are listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Stay with us, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, your host. Matt Neely's behind the glass. Tomorrow morning, you will have Grant Kruger, Food for Thought. Grant does a great job of combining both the restaurant scene and the ongoing happenings in that sector, a huge sector in the city of gastronomy in the region. There's no doubt. We were just talking, earlier with Todd Rockoff of the JCC on the Maccabi games, mm-hmm. and how people are asking what restaurant's the best Mexican. What's Grant does a great job, but he also brings a political bent, and he brings the political conversations. And tomorrow, his guest will be Senate President Warren Peterson, also a candidate for Attorney General to run against Chris Mays, but he's first got to get through a primary where Rodney Glassman, mm-hmm. another name familiar to us, is also running for the Attorney General next year. So Warren Peterson will be joining Grant. I strongly encourage you to call in and join him tomorrow on that.
And we may have a spokesperson from the Americans for Tax Reform as well.
I saw he was reaching out, yeah. and he was tentative on that. Ed Ackerley's doing a great job as kind of the leader of the morning voice on pulling in some national voices onto our show. So we hope we, again, give you something to listen to during your drive time. I'll tell you that map has never been as green as it is. Your traffic stuff's getting shorter and shorter. It's amazing how the traffic improves during the summer.
It's summertime.
I just can't figure it. It's just incredible. So, Jan, appreciate the conversations we've been having about this. Let's go to an issue that's near and dear to my heart. Let's talk about the Regional Transportation Authority. Yeah. As everybody knows, June 30th, 2026, our Regional Transportation Authority plan and tax will expire. As a member of the board, because I sit on the State Transportation Board, the only non-elected member of the RTA board, we've got 5 weeks now to either come up with a plan, because we have to get the county to vote it on September 6th, or forward it to the ballot. If they're not really mm-hmm. voting on the plan, they're forwarding the ballot for us on September 6th. Or we have to have an alternative, or we're going to be in a position where this region's going to lose significant money. Two-thirds of our regional transportation funding comes from the RTA. The other third comes from the feds and the state for our regional transportation funding. You chair the Technical Management Committee, and you've been doing a great job there, and you've been having... I mean, you're on Wednesday, you're going to have your third, fourth meeting, you know, in the last 2 weeks. It's been crazy. Yeah. What's your level of confidence that we'll get to something that will prevent us from facing this, whether people want to hear it or not, fiscal crisis? The roads aren't going to get any better without the money. I can promise you that.
Well, Ted, we don't have a choice. we have to get something to get to the ballot for just what you say. It's over a 20-year period, $2.5 billion.
On the pessimistic side,
yes, right.
That means 80% of the time it's going to be more than
right.
that.
And while roads are the largest chunk of this, we've got safety. We've got road safety. We've got some of the transit involved. And every jurisdiction, including unincorporated Pima County, uses transit. Whether it's the dial-a-ride programs, the buses, they currently exist. So we all have a need. We all have a need for what's happening with our roads, et cetera. So,
and to your point, transit takes the most immediate impact. It will be immediately a $30 million loss
every year
annually. Mm-hmm. And that does support, I mean, Oro Valley's, they're asking sure. for more transit money too.
That's
because
right.
the dial-a-ride program and the things that... There's a need. So while people argue about how much transit should or should not be in there, the fact of the matter is if we don't get this reauthorized, the transit support for the entire county will immediately be crippled.
Immediately end. And for all those folks who use that dial-a-ride program to allow them to get to a job or to get their groceries or things, it's life-sustaining and so important. So as you point out, we started... Jeepers now, maybe 5-6 weeks ago, you got a brand new interim director, Mr. Ortega's come in, and what we've seen is, first of all, extraordinary collaboration, that the groups working together, I would say what we had dealt with a period of time, I'd say the jurisdictions would develop what we thought would be a good idea for transit or for what the roads ought to look like. And we'd sort of ship it over the fence to the RTA staff who would look at it and ship questions back. What you're seeing now is much more really interactive, real-time engagement with the experts together. All the finance people are working together. They've pulled together the communications folks from the jurisdictions and RTA. A lot of conversation. The Technical Management Committee that makes the recommendations to you all at the RTA board used to meet on a Wednesday in a quarter. We've now met every Wednesday. We will this month, plus last Friday, plus yesterday, because we've got to get back to the board on Thursday with what we think we need to do. The problems that we're struggling with and what the board is struggling with, as you know better than I, we have seen a shortfall in what we anticipated in revenues in RTA of $1 billion. That's real. And so when I look back, and there are great successes that have come, you know, from RTA. And I think for unincorporated Pima County, if people want to look out at La Canada and La Cholla and some of these areas, it's extraordinary what has happened. And we can all point at wonderful things that have occurred. What starts to happen as you get near the end is people forget the good that has occurred over the last 20 years and wonder where that project is that hasn't yet been completed. And part of that is looking at $1 billion. Always difficult to project 20 years in advance. I don't think anybody thought we were going to have a recession and or a global pandemic. But what we're now looking at is, what is the plan that we bring back to you that can not only find a way to complete what we told the voters we would do in RTA and make sure that any project remaining is completed? How do we make sure that transit continues? How do we make sure that the things all the jurisdictions need and unincorporated Pima County, which is pavement reconstruction, I'm not talking just fit a pothole, but we have roads that need serious work.
And that's artillery construction is something that we've added. It was
not absolutely
in the first RTA 1.
That's right.
Now, RTA 1 was based on, I mentioned the 80% number,
right.
that's a pessimistic number. RTA 1, we based on the 50-50. I mean, so going in, when you think about it, the elected officials at that time said, we'll take a 50-50 chance that we'll get enough revenue and a 50-50 chance we won't. The pessimistic view says 80% of the time we should receive this money. Is there a chance we're going to be short? Yeah, but we couldn't have anticipated being $1 billion short, but we knew there was still a flip of a coin. So we've adjusted that. We've also recognized that arterial reconstruction is a viable solution for a couple of things. We know you do polling.
Right.
The number one thing that they want in their people in their roads is for them to be fixed. Now, I'm an Oro Valley resident. Every day I drive and I work in the city of Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
I want RTL reconstruction. That has, you know, the Oro Valley goes, well, none of those roads are in our area. I told Mayor Winfield, you're right. But what it does do is the 13,000 people that go from Oro Valley into the city of Tucson to work will be driving on better roads. Their cars will be improved. And because it's reconstruction, they're going to be good for 7 to 10 years. Still remains the city's responsibility to take care of them after we get them up there. Mm-hmm. But so many roads in the unincorporated Pima County, I know, faces this,
right.
Are in conditions that you can't pavement preservation them back into good facility.
You can't, and you shouldn't, and it's not safe. And so that's what we're really looking at. And then looking at what's RTA next look like?
Right.
You know, so that's the plan that we're trying to figure out and bring back to the board. How do we do all of that? You know, how do we keep, how do we make sure that things, there are elements of the project that were not just roads, that maybe were realigned in order to make sure roads got done, wildlife crossings, other parts of this plan. How do we make sure that the voters who wanted
anything,
intersection
improvements, active transportation,
safety,
a lot of
like
things,
that.
Yes.
How do we make sure that things that the voters supported get finished, making up for the $1 billion? And then how do we plan for the next 20 years? And then how do we bring you all at the RTA board a plan that learns from what we've gone through these last 20 years, that provides for maybe a every 5-year reboot, realignment, revisit? Are we doing the right things? Do we want at the end of the 20 years the road we thought we wanted 20 years ago? So how do we report back to the community and make those adjustments?
And I think that's some of that is just putting in the system the ability to reconsider projects and do a quarter, you know, every 5-year update. Is the projects that we said 10 years ago still what we want? Because we can always go back to the voters and get them just to reauthorize a different scope if it's significant. There's a lot of options. The option that worries me, I am a big proponent on, we need the RTA next in March.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody believes we'll get to a plan. So what are the options that are being considered from the TMC for how we can, what I would do, call a gap funding, which I think brings a whole bunch of risk, but how can we keep going and not face that cliff come July 1st of next year?
Well, and if I may, Ted, as you and I'm sure your listeners know, the concern is we can only sort of reboot the RTA tax in April. So if we vote in March, we can reboot in April. If we vote in May or November, we have to wait till the next April. That's the hitch and the giddy up, if you will. The problem is some feel that we still have so much work to do to get to the voters and explain and educate that we're not going to be ready in March. And that's the balance, because the concern, we go in March, it's not successful, jeepers, what do we do then? So I think what people are looking at is that, is it possible to go to the voters and say, here's a plan, and a plan, part B is funding. Can we go to the voters and say, here's a plan, and part B is, can the county provide a funding mechanism? What might that look like? Where are the other ways to see if there's funding that might be available to fill that in? Can we look at regional dollars, which is, again, you know it better than I, as our ADOT representative, there are other funds that mm-hmm. come into this region for transportation. Can we backfill any of that need for that gap, that Band-Aid period, right, with the other regional funds that come in? Can we move money around in different ways just to fill the gap and then refill that bucket once we get back going with a half cent through RTA, through voter-approved initiatives? So we're trying first to figure out exactly what the nut is we're trying to cover, what's the dollar amount, and then where do we find those dollars?
Yeah, there's no doubt it's a difficult situation we're in. But, I've been pushing for a long mm-hmm, time. The board's even had more meetings. I really mm-hmm. appreciate the TMC stepping up and under your leadership yeah. and others. You know, all the different municipalities, again, goes back to, here's an organization that's got elected officials representing 8 different segments, and we have to get them all in agreement.
Well, and Ted, that's what's critical. This is the regional council. This is not just a mechanism. You wouldn't need a council if the math worked, that you just collected the sales tax and then divvied it out proportionately in some way to the various jurisdictions. The purpose of this is to define and to fund things that have a regional benefit and scope.
And if we divvy, and this is my yeah. argument all along, if we divvy it up to the individual municipalities for their individual uses, they're not going to go, well, I can put this plan, it's going to be really expensive, but it will help everybody.
Right.
They're not.
You can't.
Because they have to go back in front of their voters for
That's
their
right.
votes.
And they need to work in their jurisdictions with their funding for their local needs and rely on the RTA for the regional project.
I've said that whether people like it or hate it, the Regional Transportation Authority, and to a lesser extent PAG, is the only regional effort that we've got in this region that's been successful. You talked about the county roads
right.
that are impacted. We can go down Speedway, Broadway. Yeah, there was problems, there's painful, it was, you know, nobody likes when construction, but those roads are now in much better shape than they
right.
would have been otherwise.
That's
so,
right.
All right, we're going to go to a break right now. When we come back, we're going to close with the topic of Project Blue. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Please stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 AM. Stay with us after this show for Wynn Tucson. Kathleen Wynn will bring her perspectives and political banter to the airwaves. So I'd encourage you to stay on 1030 The Voice. It is your trusted local news and talk. So Matt, thank you again for all you do for the show. Appreciate this. I'm going to come to you because I want to hear your opinion eventually, not start with it, but we want your opinion on Project Blue. So Jan, the Pima County's economic development has been a big piece of this Project Blue mm-hmm. effort. So can you kind of tell us where, from your perspective, where this sits, what your thoughts are? And we've got about, Matt may be able to get us an extra minute, four minutes. So.
Well, we've been working on this project, our economic development team and others, for 2.5-3 years. excuse me, as we move forward. And as you know, the Board of Supervisors did approve this. And our role in it is relating to the project will be on property that is currently owned by the county. If we've approved moving forward with that plan and selling that land, if the city approves the deal, then it will be annexed into the city of Tucson in order to use Tucson water, and the deal will ultimately go through. I think it's taught us a lot, I'll just say, Ted, about how we do some of the work that we do. One of the challenges and concerns that I've heard on our side of the house is that we had not really afforded enough time, perhaps, to how we reviewed the environmental piece of this. I think that that was something that our board did have an opportunity to look at, but we can do better. I'll just say that in September, we come back to the board with two things that we're looking at. One, how does our board deal with looking at environmental impacts of projects? I refer to it periodically as we don't eat the seed corn. You know, we will never be in a position as a county to say that any one project is so important that we are willing to give up the future of the area. And so the information that's worked with the board and the numbers that we've seen continue to indicate that it will be sustainable from both a water and a utility or electric perspective, and that we are not ultimately destroying the other parts of the county and the ability to deter any other future project. And so we look at that, but can we do better? Can we do that review? Obviously, the other area that we look at is the non-disclosure agreements. What does that look like? How does that, what does that mean? And is it the same for procurement as it is for any other economic development opportunity?
Absolutely, and those are some big challenges. Matt, I want to give you a second to weigh in on here. I know
I think she's got it covered. The only thing I would say is, you know, they worked on this thing for 2.5 years. Everybody knows here that water's a key issue, and I think maybe they didn't see that one coming. And it did. I think it would be great if they could have come out and announced, look, we've got the purple pipe going out there on day one, and we're going to light speed this project through. I think that would have gone a long way to head off some of the public comment. That's all I really wanted to say.
Matt, I think you're right with that. I mean, I look back, and part of it is just difficult timing. If you remember the day that our board voted to approve the plan, we had a lot of conversation about the purple pipe, the 18 miles, why we believe it was sustainable from a water perspective, and why we believe that it would not cause your utility rates to go up. And Tucson Electric Power later that day announced rates were going up.
That was very bad optics.
Completely unrelated. Yep. But it was, see, you vote for yes and the rates go up. Obviously, you're not related. Had it to do over again, would we have timed all those things a little bit differently? Yes. But there was one public hearing that I think made it difficult for people to hear all of the information. There's another one Thursday evening that will be virtual.
And everybody will have the opportunity. You won't hear people shouting out their opinions.
So that people who need questions answered, what is it about the water? What is it about air quality? How are we dealing with utility and energy consumption and power consumption? Those will be questions to which people can get an answer. And then it's my understanding there'll be another public hearing at the TCC in August.
Absolutely. And that's been the voice of Jan Lesher, our Pima County Administrator. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
I'm glad,
Ted,
you just signed it. I'm just glad you signed another 10-year contract.
Yeah, uh-oh.
Okay, that's a joke.
Right after you did.
Exactly. That's not the case.
Happening.
But I do appreciate all the leadership you're bringing to the region, and we've got a lot of work to do.
A lot of work together.
Look forward to having you back on the show later.
Appreciate you joining us. And I'll see you at RTA on Thursday.
Absolutely. I'll be there. Matt, thanks for all the work behind the glass and your contributions. I always appreciate it. And please tune in every day, 7 to 9, to The Morning Voice. And I hope to be speaking with you or to you next Tuesday again. Have a great week.